You know, 17 years ago, who'd have dreamed, you know, that we'd have this many guys at an Al-Anon meeting. Back then, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of men in Al-Anon. You know, it's great to see. Some of you may know or may not know, Candy and I moved to Lake Havasu about 2 months ago. And I told them, don't worry, I'll be back to lead the anniversary meeting. And boy, we missed you guys. But, you know, we're going to be around. We got like three homes now. We got one in Arizona, one in Utah, and then we have a daughter that has, and a son-in-law that have a guest house. So with two little grandkids, mind you, that we can't stay away from. So we'll be coming back, and we'll all be attending some meetings. Won't be quite every week, but, and we're gonna make it work out. So, you know, I tell this story every year, because a lot of people ask how the meeting really got started. I have to keep deferring to my wife, you know. You know, I'm so grateful to be married to an alcoholic. I never thought I'd be saying that. I heard that from a speaker when I was new, and I thought I wanted to puke. And today I honestly believe that because I wouldn't have found Al-Anon without her and finding AA. And so we're trudging the road together. And you know, it's working. But, you know, I was a whiner in the early days when I started going down on, and she was newly sober, and we did a trip around the Northwest and decided to go to a meeting in every state, and that was really a lot of fun. And we ended up in Palm Springs, and there was a men's Al-Anon meeting and a regular AA meeting at the Betty Ford Center this particular night, so we went, and I just loved the meeting, and she did too. And we got to talking afterward, you know, I said, boy, I'd love to have a men's group in La Cañada, because that's where we lived. So she said, well, quit whining and just start one. You know? It didn't even dawn on me. I said, yeah, I guess I could. You know, I'd been going to a group that's, you know, meeting started at 8:30 and it was over at 10. And then the meeting after the meeting, I was getting home at midnight and I had to wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning because I had an early class to teach. You know, it just wasn't working for me, you know. You know, I wasn't willing to go to any lengths at that time, I guess. But anyway, so she really was the inspiration for the meeting. You know, I started it, you know, 17 years ago in October 1991. And we had about six guys at first meeting, and two of which are still here. Three of us, three out of the six, half of us are still here. And it's just grown since then. And, you know, about 3 years into the meeting, it was really interesting because Willie, who was one of the original guys, and he came in and he had been to some kind of conference. I don't know what it was, World Service or something. And he says, you know what? He says, a lot of men have names, you know, on their groups. And they put it right in the directory, you know. We got to call ourselves something, you know. And, of course, what he wanted to call was the La Cañada Men's Kick-Ass Group. And that's a true story. And we said, yeah, yeah. And then they said, well, you know what? I don't think they're going to print that in the directory. So we kind of kicked some other things around. It took a few months, actually. And they, I guess they don't put that in the directory anymore, the names. But they used to. And so we you know, got on it and decided to call it, you know, 7 o'clock, let's rock. And the way that came about was there's a song that Elton John sings called Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting. And I don't think I've ever said the from the beginning, but it says, hey mates, have you seen my boys? Oh man, now I can't even remember because I never say it. It's getting late, have you seen my mate? Yeah. Tell me when the boys get here. It's 7 o'clock and I want to rock. I want to get a belly full of beer. My old man's drunker than a barrel full of monkeys, and my old lady, she don't care. My sister looks cute in her braces and boots with a handful of grease in her hair. And, you know, if that's not a tale about, you know, alcoholism, and I don't know what is. But anyway, that kind of stuck, you know, because that's what happened. I want to start the meeting at 7 o'clock, not 8:30. I wanted to do it in my hometown, so I didn't have to drive very far. Really, all selfish on my part. And that's how it started, you know, and it's just kind of grown from there. And thanks to a lot of guys, all you guys, it's just, it's been flourishing. And Dan, we're getting so big. I mean, I took off 2 months ago, and it's bigger now than when after I left, you know. I guess they figured get their help, Pat, out of the way, and we'll really start a meeting. So, but it's been great. And the recovery, I just can't thank you enough. It's just done a lot for my program. And I missed you guys, but I'm gonna keep coming back. Anyway, with that, I'm going to introduce our speaker. You know, I met Ajit, Candy and I did about 20 years ago. He probably didn't remember this. We went to a conference up in San Luis Obispo, and he was speaking at it. And I remember the slogan that year was "Surrender to Win." And I, you know, I told you people before, I'm a slow learner. You know, I didn't come in down on and fall in love and find home and all that stuff that people talk about. It took me a couple of years. I mean, I went to meetings and hung around the fringes, but I didn't jump in with both feet till about 2.5 years. And I looked at that slogan, and I thought, boy, is that stupid. You know, how could anybody surrender to win? You know, it's a lot like the thing about being grateful to be married to an alcoholic. How could anybody, you know, wish that? And it took me a while to get it, but I finally did, thank God. The aha happened for me. But G was speaking that weekend, you know, he was really another big part of men's group. But a few weeks after that, I went down to his men's group, which was at the time was down in Costa Mesa. And I went down to that meeting. It was on Thursday night. And I walked in there a little late, 5 minutes late. I couldn't find the place all the way down in Orange County. And there must have been 80 guys in this room, very similar to what we have now. Except I guess now we're even over 80. But I couldn't believe it. And you know, this was 20 years ago when there wasn't a lot of men in Al-Anon, you know. But boy, what a meeting. And that was, so that stuck in my mind. You know, I said, someday, wouldn't it be nice to have a men's group in La Cañada? And, you know, it came true. So I just feel so blessed. And so, you know, Ajit, we've been in contact over the years. He's come and spoken at our men's offsite weekend or men's retreat, whichever one you want to call it. And, Candy and I have had him, he and his, I guess his fiance or girlfriend, you know, have gone to the couples group that we go to in San Juan Capistrano. And that's been a real pleasure and delight for us. So anyway, at this time, I'd like to introduce and help you me welcoming Ajit.
Well, thank you. I guess I can sit down. I have the applause. I'm done. My name is Ajit. God, thank you for not saying oh shit and ash shit, because I got about 90-odd versions of my name. I want to thank Steve for asking me to come out and share my story with you. I always say share my experience and strength, and if you get any hope out of it, that's up to you. And I want to thank Willie for bringing me a bottle of water. Half measures of availed us nothing. And I want to welcome all my friends in Al-Anon. Hello. And to Bernie, Ron, Leslie, and Murta, a double one. Any alcoholics in this room? No alcoholics? Oh, we do. Welcome as well. Why do we do that to alcoholics? There's a comedian, Mitch Hedberg, who said, alcoholism is the only disease for which you get yelled at. You don't go up to a cancer patient and say, I thought you were in remission, for God's sake. I thought it was a great line. Any double winners in here? Welcome. Schizophrenic bunch of people. Self-centered and obsessed with behavior. That's totally into themselves, I'm sure. Punch yourself at every meeting this way. The name is of Indian extraction. I'm originally from Bombay, India. And no, I don't own a Shell gas station or a 7-Eleven. I'm not a medical doctor or a software engineer. And I don't have an out-call service program anyplace. But I do wear the spikes on my golf shoes on the inside. No, I'm kidding. The way I play golf, I should. Self-flagellation. I'm really appreciative of Steve asking me to come out. I don't do much of this anymore because, as Pat was talking about, I'm now engaged, and my fiance asked me one day, she said, why do you do go talk? I said, well, I'm being of service. She said, what about the ego? And I said, what are you talking about, ego? There's no ego. I've been doing this for a long time. She said, oh, really? And I started to reflect on it, and I said, oh, my God, you know, because I get asked to speak at a conference, and I find out I'm the Friday night speaker and not the luncheon speaker, and something sparks. Why did they not ask me to be the luncheon speaker? That's ego. So here it is, my ego and all are out here in front of you to share my story. Candy's laughing. I'm grateful for the alcoholic in my life as well, because I found Al-Anon. And, you know, my story is that of a recovering arrogant prick. I can say that. And you're laughing, but I think you'll identify, because arrogance shows up in many forms, not just in terms of boastfulness and pride and the overt sense, but in the caretaking and enabling. I'm better than you. I've heard many people in Al-Anon say, oh, those alcoholics, as if they're less than the Al-Anon. Until I started to read this book, and if you've seen the movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? And one of the chaps has written a book called Evolve Your Brain. And I'm learning that we're all addicted to some friggin' emotion. And he's talking about how there are neuroreceptor cells in us that scream for these chemicals. And we have pattern thinking. Then the brain is producing those chemicals to feed those neuroreceptors. I said, oh my God, I'm as addicted as the next alcoholic, except I don't go drink and drive and crash into things and pull checks from the middle of the checkbook to buy my booze or any of that crap. But my head's got a thing going on. I mean, I could qualify for the carpool lane all by myself if the cops could just, you know, get in there and visit my committee, so to speak. You know, I'm no better than the alcoholic. I mean, just because they have a drinking problem doesn't make the person any less of a human being. And I hear this, and I hear the alcoholics joke about the Al-Anons too. As one guy said, I won't make any jokes about Al-Anons, but I can say, how many Al-Anons does it take to change a light bulb? None. They let it screw itself. That's a nasty one. Why did God make alcohol so ugly people could have sex? Now, it's awful. It's actually to keep the Irish from taking over the world. You're Irish, CIA. Anyway, if you're new, welcome. Happy birthday to the birthday folks, and happy 17th to this group. What a marvelous group. Pat was telling me about 100 odd guys show up, and every now and then a woman shows up. Nice place to troll, isn't it? So it's been a long ride for me, I tell you. I was going to start off by saying how alcoholics say, thanks to my God and my big book of AA and my sponsor, I haven't had a drink in X number of years. And I was going to say, thanks to my sponsor and the God of my understanding and the big book of Al-Anon, I have not had an obsessive thought, and I've been totally detached for the last 28 years. That's not true. That's always wonder when we Al-Anon celebrate and take cakes. How can you go 365 days being totally detached and non-obsessive in your thinking and totally into yourself? I don't know, but we take birthday cakes. I was selling candy. I said, the more we have disdain for the alcoholics, we have our meetings that are becoming more and more patterned after AA meetings where we take chips and coins and cakes and all that good stuff. That's terrific. So newcomers, I hope you come back. Maybe this talk will keep you from coming back, but if you come back next week. And my first half of the story, and Jack's probably heard it a few times, so he's probably going to chuckle, okay, he said this, he said that before. But it's my story. The first half of the story is primarily what has happened and what changed and what brought me here today. And I'm very grateful for where I am today. I don't live with the alcoholic, so to speak, in my life. I never referred to her as my qualifier. She was more of an usher. The qualifier rests right between my ears. They say heaven, a mind is a place of itself, making hell of heaven and heaven of hell. And I can create catastrophe and crises in my head. I don't need the alcoholic to do that. She simply, I think, fostered the environment to allow this thing to kind of get triggered and go moving. Anyway, we are divorced. We were married 17 years. She's been sober now 25 years. I'll tell you what my problem is. I hear people take their birthday cakes and announce the date that they had walked into the meeting. I can't recall at all when exactly I walked in. It was circa 1980. But I can tell you to the moment when she walked into AA. May 25th, 1983, 8.02 p.m. That tells you where my head was. At the corner of University and Culver in Irvine. And the other disease I have that has been a bane of my existence, and thank God it's diminishing significantly, and it's a disease called image management. I may feel like crap, but I got to look good. Why do I look good? I have to look good? Because you guys are judging me and checking me out. Why do I have that? Because as a child growing up, my mother's mantra was, what will they say? I had no idea who these they were that had no lives of their own because they were so focused on mine. But not only were they judging me based on how I walked, looked, and talked, but they were judging me by the company I kept, because in school you had this phrase, birds of a feather fly together. So you got to make sure you're the right company. And that's how I ended up in Al-Anon, as I tell you my story. Yes, I did grow up in Bombay. I finished up with my schooling, and I walked up the proverbial mountain, as most Indians do. I think I see an Indian chap in the back there, but I'm not sure if, yeah, you raise his hand. How come you didn't applaud when I said I'm from India? Anyway, I walked up the mountain. I said, oh, great guru, I seek serenity. And he said, go to Detroit, Michigan and join Al-Anon. So, I just say that for effect. It's a lie. So I leave the shores of Bombay, and I want to tell you, I had not encountered, I thought, alcoholism in my home. Despite there was a lot of insanity, I had an uncle who could literally qualify as a schizophrenic, neurotic, you name it, all the icks that are there he would qualify for, but he did not drink. I wish he had drunk, then he would have calmed himself down. But the real person in our family was another uncle who had the disease of alcoholism, except we did not know that he was alcoholic. We attributed what he had to a weakness in character, a lacking in willpower, morally decrepit, because he gambled a lot, smoked a lot, and he lived, God forgive him, in the wrong part of town. We were snobs. And so we never really attributed what he had to alcoholism, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. Until I was in sixth grade, my sixth standard, then my headmaster, we call him vice principal here, I found out had started the first chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous in Bombay, India. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, what the hell is Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, oh, they get drunks off the street and get them sober. Little did I know that, figuratively at least, AA would come to my now former spouse's rescue. And thank God she's been sober. And thank God, because of her alcoholism, that I found this great program. Because I tell you, when I used to go with my wife to Hoag Hospital to listen to AA speakers, and I would listen to their story, and I would ask my wife, you think I'm alcoholic? And she said, no, you don't drink like the alcoholics. I said, but I identify with a lot of the feelings. And she said, stay away from my program. You go to yours. So... Anyway, I left Bombay, India with friends and family, meaning friends and family, warning me, said, do not get involved with American women. Only the ones from La Cañada is fine. So I said, why? And they said, because they drink and smoke in the open like men do. Translation, discreet Indian women do it behind closed doors. So I end up in Detroit, and I'm there. And I did not really care if the American woman smoked, but I loved the fact that she drank. Because they say candy's dandy and liquor's quicker. It made my progress in an evening extremely cost-effective and expedient. I was like that Alan Alda character in MASH. My kind of woman, drunk. How stupid, I tell you. I wasted many a dollar and many an hour trying to be hip and cool in a bar called Yesterday's in Detroit, trying to meet my soulmate du jour. I'm sorry. Oh, Lord. You know, when I tell you the story, it's my past. It's not who I am today. But when I look upon it, it's like I'm having an out-of-body experience looking at this person and say, what an idiot. How did you get from there to here? And the only thing is, it's this bloody program. It did not make sense to me in the beginning, but now it makes total sense how this thing works, because what the program is talking about is changing my thinking and my attitudes. And I didn't realize this thing that I'm reading about, the chemical addiction, if I have to watch my thoughts, forget the thoughts, I have to be really responsible to that first thought, discipline that first thought. If I catch that first thought, and they say one drink is too many and 1,000 aren't enough, my one thought is too many and 1,000,000 thoughts that cascade after that aren't enough. So if I stop, Eckhart Tolle always says that, if you have read any of his books, so watch that first thought like a cat watching a mouse hole, a rat hole, just waits there patiently. And I said, oh my God, that takes a lot of discipline. And it does. But that's what I have. It's my problem is my thinking. And because I faulty thinking changes my perceptions, changes my attitudes, changes my thinking. And I've been a bloody victim for the longer part of my life than I really care to even admit. And that's what this program has done. It's brought me face to face with me, someone who now feels comfortable in his skin. I never felt comfortable. I'd rather stand up and say, my name is Bond, James Bond. You know, sound like Sean instead of saying I'm a G. You know, it just doesn't sound sexy enough. I do a horrible impression of Sean. The wife beater. Anyway, it was image management. Jack said go an hour, 45 minutes. Pat said do an hour and a half, but I'll stick to an hour. So I'll move along and tell you how it was. And some of the women here will think I was a cad. You're right, I was. I'm a recovering cad. I'm no longer a cad. And I'll tell you why I was a cad. I'd finished up with my education in Detroit, my degree, and then I was teaching part-time at the university from where I graduated. And I was also working for Xerox. And a boss of mine at Xerox had a party at his home, and he invited me. And the woman that I was seeing at the time, if you want to call it that, dating casually at the time, did not fit the image that I wanted to present at my boss's house. My God has a sense of humor. So I'm looking for the right image to carry with me to this party so I would look right. And I'm sitting in this place called TJ's, which is a student hangout at Wayne State in Detroit. And this woman who's working her way through nursing school comes and waits at our table. And I always say that Al-Anons carry a little beam that zones in. Alcoholic, no, don't waste your time. Alcoholic, no, don't waste your time. I need a purpose in life. I need an alcoholic to take care of, a project to handle, right? So my beam is going on, can't find the alcoholic. She comes and waits, and the beam takes off. Here's the alcoholic. You're going to tell her lies, mend her relationships, and take care of her. And her beam took off, says, here's the moron who's going to take care of me. So I ask her out, and she gives me this line about, I've never been out with anyone from this establishment. You're the first one. So it puffs up my already fragile ego. And we go out. So I ask her out to the party, but before the party, we decide to go have dinner. Now, normally when I went out to dinner with a woman, I'd listen with an open mind, in one ear, out the other, because I'm strategizing as to the post-dinner events. But something was off that evening. I was actually indulging in intellectual intercourse with this woman. We were having a conversation. She was talking, I was actually listening, and we were communicating. It was very scary, but I persisted because, see, the guy told me, seek serenity, and I was going to find serenity where they'd kill me, which almost did a few times. So we end up this party, and my buddy shows up and he says, how long have you and Susan been going out? 7-8 years? I said, George, I just met this woman last week. This is our first date. He said, oh my God, you look so comfortable together. So the Indian in me comes out and says, oh, it must be karmic thing from past life or something. You know? And this is the only time I proselytize from the podium. If you feel that comfortable with someone on your first date, one of you ought to leave. As I say, the rocks in your head fit the holes in theirs, or vice versa. Anyway, we started to go out, and we now started to have an exclusive relationship for about 4 months. And about 4 or so months later, there was a knock on the door. And as I opened the door, out stands this woman with a lump on her head. And I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "My mother struck me in an alcoholic rage." Now, here comes the knight in shining armor, the parent, you know, the whatever. 15 personalities came gushing out and wanted to literally take in this woman and take care of her. Said, "You will not move in with that woman. You will move in with me." Now, a Hindu from Bombay, India does not ask a Polish Catholic girl to move in with him, as you see. The scary part was not the fact that she had a mother who was a very devout Catholic who disavows sinful relationships in terms of living together, and I'm actually watching this woman help her daughter move in with me. Totally contrary to her principles. And I said, if I had any intellect in me, I would have said, something is not right with this picture. I should give the mother and daughter my key to the apartment and flee. But I was in La La Land. Oh, wow, you know, mom's helping her move in. This is a real blessing. She's blessing the event. She was detaching. Actually, not detaching. She was removing herself geographically from the person. And Susan moved in, and we had a wonderful first 15 minutes. Oh, Lord. You know, strange occurrences started to happen in that place. Doors started to bang. Now, I come from a home where you were not supposed to raise your voice. Was, what will they say? So I would say, "Susan, I'm really angry." And she said, "Who the hell do you think you are? Prince Charles?" And that's, and saying, "The neighbors will hear, the neighbors will hear." And I'm shutting the windows and doors. And then sounds emanating from the bedroom, and I'm not even there. And I, you know, something is not right. And I have no clue what's going on. And so we decided to do the next indicated thing. We got married. If all else fails, tie the knot. What do they say? When a woman marries, she hopes the man will change. When a man marries, he hopes she will not change. This was going. Thank you, Willie. This is really good, man, I tell you. But if I drink any more of this, I'll have to take a break. Anyways, we lived in marital bliss for a short time when all things started to crash around us, and I couldn't figure out what the hell is going on. And we moved into this little condo that we purchased and made it our abode. And then I knew something wasn't going on, but you know, I was not in denial. The reason I say that, to be in denial, you have to have some sense of awareness. I was clueless. And the reason I was clueless is because I had no depth to my personality. I was mildly sociopathic, I think, at the time. Because all that matters was me, and you played a role in my life as long as you were serving me, except I did not know all this cognitively. So I really did not connect with this woman in any form, at any intimate level, in terms of, aside from the physical, but no emotional intimacy, no transparency. There was no connection that I'm experiencing in my current relationship. This is very, very transparent and a tremendous amount of intimacy, the emotional and spiritual kind. My spouse and I at the time had none of that. The only thing was, here's this woman, there's strange stuff going on, I have no idea what it is, until image management came into play. My family had moved into another part of Michigan, the Detroit area, and I was going to introduce them to the white sheep of our family, so we're going to drive there and meet them. As we're driving, she gets into a fight with me, and I said, "No, I can't take you in this condition, because I smell binaca a little too strongly, and I couldn't figure out what it was." So I drive her back to the house, and she runs in. Now, I got to tell you, we had a half bathroom downstairs, and I did not know that that was her bar. I had no clue, because I'd walk in occasionally into that bathroom, and I'd open the door, 6 or 7 empty cans of beer would topple out. And I'd be upset. I'd go to my wife and say, "What were those empty cans of beer doing down on the cabinet floor? Why were they not in the trash?" I was more concerned about that. And she'd say, well, Aunt Bunny came over and had a few beers. It never occurred to me to call up Aunt Bunny and say, why do you have to take a six-pack into the bathroom, for God's sake? You know? And this one I couldn't figure out. I said, my buddy Tom shows up. I said, would you like a glass of wine? He said, sure. So I reach into the cabinet, pull out this bottle of wine. It's got the cork, it's got the wrap, it's got that little red thing around it, but the bloody thing is empty. I don't know if there are special stores that cater to alcoholics that sell long syringes. You poke in and pull all the booze out to mess with the Al-Anon's mind. But anyway, I drop her off. She runs into this half bathroom, and I walk by, and she's trying to shut the door because she thought I had left. And she's trying to shut the door to the cabinet, and inside I saw was a 55-gallon drum of Gallo wine. It was a half a gallon jug. And at that moment, all the cluelessness and all the denial and whatever was going on just kind of washed away. And I'm sitting and staring at this woman, and a little voice comes into my head and says, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic, your wife's an alcoholic. I said, oh my God. And the next thought that came into my head is, I'll take care of it. And if you're new and you have a lot of time on your hands and not much of a life, then you may want to try some of these things. It's entertaining, but it serves no purpose. So the first thing I did, I used to watch a lot of television, and there was a Schick Schadl commercial. I don't know if you've seen that, where the wife goes up to her husband and says, sweetheart, you have a drinking problem. He said, honey, you're so right. And they go get treated. I think an alcoholic wrote that copy on that ad. So I, who believes in truth in advertising, walked up to my wife and said, honey, you have a drinking problem. She said, you're an idiot. I don't. Now I got to resort to plan B. I don't have much of a plan B. So my logical, which is almost illogical, mind said, she's denying the fact that she has a drinking problem because she hasn't been caught in the act. If you catch her in the act, then she'll know that you know she has a drinking problem and she'll be confronted with the truth. So this is what I did, because I did not have much of a life and I had a lot of time. I would sit on the couch watching a blank television set, pretending to do the crossword so I could catch a reflection of what's going on in the kitchen. I would watch her pour her drink, and I'd make this Archimedean exclamation like I've discovered a new law in physics. I'd say, aha! She's taking a drink. And then she'd crawl up to the bedroom with some semblance of dignity, held quite high. And I'd get up and I'd move the booze around, thinking when she comes down, she'll look for her booze in the spot she left it, and she will not find it, and she'll know I know, and then she'll stop. So now it's 2 a.m, it's feed time for the baby, meaning her, and I'm awake pretending to be asleep, because I want to be discreet about this. Watch her go down, I hear this clink, 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 clang, clang. Many years later, I heard an alcoholic say that they always had their stash in 19,000 places, just in case. In fact, I think I was more creative in where I thought she would hide her booze, so much so that I was arrested for molesting my vacuum cleaner. I was really playing with that bag to see if she'd been hiding her booze in that vacuum. I don't think she was that creative. Anyway, it wasn't working. I tried different things. Finally, I said, you know what, I can leave. So I put my little clothes in a bag and I'm walking out, and she follows me to the door. She said, if you leave, I will commit suicide. Now, I'm not making light of suicide, but if you don't give a darn, keep walking. I said, that I want to watch so you don't botch it up. And I followed her to the kitchen. Wrong move, because in that 15 nanoseconds, her intentions changed from suicide to homicide. And she's throwing dishes and knives at me across the room with absolute accuracy. She could have played for the Angels and won them the pennant already. I mean, this was coming at 90 miles an hour, spit at me, and this image-conscious idiot is dodging them because I don't want to run out. She might follow me. If she follows me, then the neighbors will find out that I'm married to an alcoholic. Which brings me to the point, why do alcoholics get anonymous after they get sober? They drank anonymously. We'd be all okay. I contemplated homicide myself. I decided to kill her. I said, I can't leave. She's got fatal attraction toward me. So I'm going to kill her. And I come from the land of Gandhi. You're supposed to starve yourself. Starvation was not an option. So I was reading this English magazine called Argosy. It's a novel, stories. And Alfred Hitchcock described the perfect murder weapon, which is an icicle. So he pulled it out, and here in February, these icicles dangling. He said, I'll take it one, kill her. I'll go in the basement, dig up the basement, pour it. I don't know anything about masonry or cement or what have you. Who cares? Minor details. And pour cement. And then a thought occurred to me. Wait a minute. My mother-in-law lives 3 miles away. She'll find dust on my wife's car, and she'll call the police. And kiddo, you didn't come all the way from Bombay, India, to befriend some guy named Bubba in a Michigan prison. And being traded for cigarettes was not an option. So I was at a loss. I didn't know what to do. And finally, the twins came to my rescue. Ann Landers and Dear Abby. Oh, yes. In Al-Anon, I've discovered my feminine side. I didn't need to date anyone. I took myself out to dining and dancing. No, I'm terrible. And I'm reading this thing by Ann Landers that says, if you're a child or mother or father or whatever of an alcoholic, go to Al-Anon. I said, finally, 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 someone's going to tell me how to get this woman sober. So I march into my first Al-Anon meeting, which was nothing like this. It was well lit. The room was well lit, but my perceptions were really off. I saw a dark, dingy, dank, dirty room. I saw 6 women in there, average age deceased. That's what I saw. Blue hair and sitting around. They're about my age now. I was an arrogant prick, no doubt. I knew everything, therefore I didn't need to learn. And that's been my bane. And I went up to the big kahuna of them all. She seemed more authoritarian than the rest. I said, how does this thing work? And she pointed me to the literature table. She said, there's a pamphlet there called 12 Steps. Go read that. So I figured I'd read the 12 Steps. I graduate and I leave. I don't need to come back. So I read the first step. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. I said, I certainly don't have a problem over alcohol. My life isn't unmanageable. Totally clueless. I said, go on to step 2. Doesn't apply to you. Go to move 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I said, I'm the sane one. She's the insane one. Sane people don't promote suicide. They don't contemplate homicide. They don't come up to the wife and say, hi, honey, how you doing? Then you sniff and kiss and suck the breath out of them. They don't go into garbage cans and start looking for bottles to see what their wife has been drinking. You know, I was indulging in garbology. Kmart champagne, how gauche. She didn't let the red wine breathe. It has a cap. I went to my sponsor and said, oh my God, I was going through garbage cans. They sent sponsors from one upmanship school. If you're an idiot, he wants to show you he's a bigger idiot because he's been there. He looked at me, he says, that's nothing. I said, what do you mean that's nothing? He said, I worked as a mechanic in the army and I used to have a flashlight in my mouth so I could work in the dark with both hands. He said, and that trait came in handy because at night I could have a flashlight and go through 2 garbage cans. I didn't have the heart to tell him, go to Granger Industrial Supply, buy a miner's helmet. So Leslie, Ron, Murda, Bernie, be good to yourself. If you're going through garbage cans, buy a helmet with a flashlight. I moved on to step 3, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I said, why give back to God that which he's given to me? That would make me an Indian giver. That's it. I had to say it, sorry. If you can call that the Texas tan, I can say that. And then the 5th one, I said, that doesn't apply. So the 4th step, took a fearless and personal moral inventory. I was perfect. I lived with this woman. For God's sake, she'd give me a sainthood. Step 5 goes against the credo of image management. First, there was nothing wrong with me. If there were, I'm not going to tell you about it. Are you nuts? 6 and 7 I glossed over because there was nothing there. 7 had a word that was not my style. It contained the word humbly. Actually, I was so humble, I was proud of it. So I moved on to 8. This is all happening in 3 minutes. I'm looking at step 8. It says, made a list of persons I'd harmed. They deserved it. Step 9, when is she going to make amends to me, for God's sake, for all the hassle she's put me through? I'm waiting for them to tell me how to get this woman sober, and they make me read these stupid 12 steps. So I'm reading the 10th one, you know, to continue. They did not read that. 11th, oh, I'm praying all the time. 6 Hail Marys, get her killed, God. 12 Hail Marys, don't get anyone else involved. Forget it, just bring her back. I was spiritually awakened in 3.5 minutes, and I looked at the woman, and I said, now what? And she looked at me incredulously, and she said, keep coming back. I said, why? She said, because you're sick. And she said it with such emphasis. So I did. I go back every 6 weeks. Now I'm entering into a means of a schooling of sorts, a program that's going to change my thinking, my attitudes. It's going to get to the core of my psyche and alter the way I look at life, change my paradigm, shift everything about me, spiritually and otherwise. And I'm going to do this by going to class every 6 weeks and be arrogant and tell them what they should be doing with their spouses. As a woman, I would ask a woman, why haven't you left your husband? She said, because he supports me. In my mind, I'm saying, oh, what a prostitute. I'm judging the woman, because what do we have in Al-Anon? I've discovered the toughest thing for me in Al-Anon was to make a decision, to find out what my choices were. I'm going to leave around November. It's too much around Thanksgiving. How about December? No, that's Christmas. I'll wait till February. That's Valentine's Day. Summer, how can I leave in summer? That's not right. The ability to make a sitting on that fence post with 1 foot in, 1 foot out, and a splinter up, you know what? Didn't know what I was doing. I had no clue. And I was going to these meetings, regaling these poor women with what had happened the 6 weeks prior, what idiotic things she had done to make my life miserable. This victim sat then because he could tell in a funny way, oh, who wants to do step one? I'd raise my hand because I'd never gone beyond step one. I did not understand what step one was till my sponsor in California. I want to tell you that I've been in program 28 years, but it really took hold of me when I was 17 years old in program. Why? Because it was all stuck in here. I'm a pseudo-intellectual. When I moved, this is what happened in Detroit. We left Detroit and moved to Chicago. I went to Schaumburg. You know, in Detroit they would tell me, oh, it's a disease like cancer. It's a disease like diabetes. If she had cancer or diabetes, would you leave? And you know, you don't do that to a pseudo-intellectual. Because my mind would split into two different minds and start arguing. We'd have a debate like Joe and Sarah are having tonight. And my mind would say, if she's got cancer, you cannot leave. The other side would say, well, why isn't she seeking chemotherapy then? Diabetes, why isn't she seeking insulin therapy? It wasn't when I moved on to Schaumburg, walked into my Al-Anon meeting. And I'm not suggesting you do this at your meeting, because I got chastised for even saying this in my story. But I brought this disease thing up. I said, no, I don't understand this disease concept with this diabetes, cancer, and all of the crap. He said, well, if you want to know what the real meaning of this disease is, go to the literature table and pick up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was at an Al-Anon meeting. So I read the first 163 pages, and it occurred to me that this disease really transcends physiological and physical definitions of disease and enters realms of spiritual and emotional things that even Carl Jung threw up his hands and said, I don't understand. So how the hell was this puny mind trying to figure out what this disease was? Until today, if you ask me, has alcoholism been your problem? I'd say no. My problem has been obsession with behavior, because when Susan stopped drinking, she also had a food addiction. So I'm focused on food. In fact, I told her once, I said, in you alcoholics, you give up booze, then you're obsessed over smoking. You give that up, then it's exercise, then it's sugar, then it's something. And then my mind said, wait a minute, your observation has moved right along. You're focused on all these activities along them. So you're not free from addiction and obsession. Who the hell are you saying that they're obsessed? And that's when that first spark happened. And then I went through the meetings in Chicago, and I was going to 3 meetings. But in Chicago, what happened is a lot of literature study. So I'm reading the literature. Now I'm getting philosophical about the bloody thing. I'm engaging in discourse and debate about what this step, you know, when he talks about a God of my understanding, do we really understand God? Who cares? You know? Wait a minute, the syntax in this thing is not right. Maybe this step should have come here. What does he mean by here? We're having an intellectual discussion about the bloody steps instead of working them. And I wasn't working them. I thought because I was reading them that I knew what the hell it was all about. And if I knew what it was all about, therefore I... And then I could communicate that quite well, I suppose, with people come up to me and say, boy, I really loved your sharing. You must work a great program. And I would preen inside. My God, finally someone's recognizing without knowing that I was thinking that. And I was dying inside, didn't know I was dying inside because I wasn't really walking the talk. I was just talking the talk and not recognizing that. It wasn't until we moved to California, going to meetings, and this is when the program is slowly starting to happen. My sponsor and I would sit down and I said, what exactly is the first step? He said, the first step is essentially identifying. Excuse me, I keep reaching down because I want to put this up here. Is identifying what the problem is. See, in my, you know, one day at a time, it says, acceptance is simply admitting the existence of a reality. It has nothing to do with approval. It's admitting the existence of a reality. And I'm driving and my mind clicks on and says, wait a minute, isn't your reality contingent upon your perceptions? And my other mind said, absolutely. I said, then what if my perceptions are off? Then is my reality truly my reality? Now I'm getting to be really heavy in my own head. I'm having an LSD experience when I've never had LSD. But it's true. You know, what we perceive to be true, I'm walking in, I can make judgments about people. I have no clue. I hardly know any of you, right? Personally, I had a dear, dear friend in Al-Anon. If you met him, and some of you know him, Albar, if you met him and you saw him, he was a paragon of the program. Always smiling, had the light in his eyes, being of service every which way. But the guy committed suicide. Blew my mind away, pardon the pun. And I said, do I really know the people I think I know? Do I really share at that intimate level with everyone that I come across, say, what's going on with you today? Because he did not pick up the phone and call anyone, say, I'm in pain, that I'm going to commit suicide. I called him Monday afternoon after his wife told him she was going to give him a divorce, and he was supposed to meet me Tuesday morning for breakfast. Instead, he went and bought bullets and took himself Tuesday and never returned. And I said, here I am judging without knowing what the hell is going on. So my reality, truly, I don't know what the problem is. Half the time, I think it's the drunk. It's not the drunk. It's the way I perceive life. It's the way I make choices, the way I'm thinking. This is what my sponsor is telling me. Step one tells you what's your problem. You've got to identify the problem. Step two gets you to that place of options. What are my options? Because if I focus on the problem, he says, the problems keep growing. We move in the direction of our dominant thoughts. I'm standing in my shower, and I tend to get my best thinking, if you will, in the shower. And I'm staring at my white tile, and there's a black ant stuck to the tile. It's dead, but it's stuck. And I'm thinking, what protein, what adhesive in the protein causes the ant? I'm throwing this water at the ant, and all of a sudden, the ant is getting larger and larger, and the wall is shrinking. And it hit me, oh my God, that's what I do. I get so focused on my problems that I don't see the bloody solution because I'm stuck in there. I came to step three then, I was stuck. I couldn't move across step three. Because he said, God of my understanding, I don't understand God. I have no clue what God is. People sit and say, God is this, God is love, God gets angry, God gets this. Those are all human, it's a concept. I like what the Buddhists say, if you meet the Buddha, kill him. Because it's a mental construct. Now, I'm not suggesting this is wrong or right for you. It's just for me, I was raised in a religion or in a home. Hinduism actually is a philosophy, but in my home, we pray to different deities on different days. God, I want this. Give me wealth. Give me fortune. Give me wealth. Give me health. It's always ask, 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 ask. Give me, give me, give me, give me. When I come to this problem, I say, take it away, take it away, take it away, take it away. Why? Because it goes back to the original philosophy where if you read Chuck C's book, A New Pair of Glasses, all that has to be given has been given. God cannot give any more. It's the stuff that blocks it that I have to remove. And this is the spiritual part the program says. When I take away the clouds out of me, the sun is already shining. I can't ask for more faith. I can't ask for anything else. I just ask for the fear to be removed and the blocks to be removed. So God's grace. So I got stuck on step three. I said, what am I turning over? What is my will? I have no clue what is God's will. Is God going to take... There was a great line in Law and Order. He says, when you pray, when you speak to God, you're considered pious. But if God talks back to you, you're considered neurotic. I mean, psychotic. God's talking. Idi Amin. But today I'm very comfortable with my concept of God. I decided I'm not going to sit and pray the way I prayed as a child. I'm just going to connect through step 11 because my God is too vast for me to contain it into a personality. Because if I could contain it into a personality, then I will start to manipulate it. And I was sitting and listening to a lecture by this, this spiritual guy, and he started off by saying, when you want to connect with God, you don't need the rite and the ritual. You don't need the incense and the sandalwood and the flowers. I said, wow, finally someone is... It resonates. Then halfway down, he says, when you sit down to pray, you need the flowers and the incense and the ritual and the rite. And I walked up to him. I said, you contradicted yourself. He said, oh, no. He said, there are some people who need the ambiance. If you can sit down and meditate and connect with the Supreme, the It, or whatever you want to call it, fantastic. There are people who do need to go to church or temple or mosque or whatever, the synagogue, because they need the ambience to connect. They need to have the Godhead to connect with the beyond. And I said, you know, it's cool. So who am I to argue with whose thing it is? Anyway, where my growth really happened, and I'm getting to the end here, I've got about 15 odd minutes left, is my wife, who had been sober 8 years, and in this 8 years, we delivered 4 beautiful children, all immaculately conceived. Twins and 2. I asked my wife, how did that happen? And then I finally figured it out. And in 8 years sober, she comes to me and she said, I've been having these dreams and I've been having these awarenesses. Something terrible happened to me in my childhood. A priest, a dad, an uncle sexually molested me. And I said, wow. And she said, that's going to change our relationship. And it did. The intimacy that we had dissipated slowly. We started to move apart. We went to counseling together for this, but just nothing was clicking. And one day she woke up and she said, this marriage is over. And I tell you, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. And whatever was in here that I had stuffed in through image management, the resentments, the anger that I had not worked through the steps, came bubbling out. I mean, I was using language that a stereotypical sailor would have blushed hearing that kind of stuff. The rage caught me by surprise. I'm beating up a kitchen cabinet. The poor thing had nothing to do with it. Got this cleaver and I'm being an O.J. Simpson-like thing, scaring the hell out of her. And then came out the 75-year-old Jewish guy. Oy vey, I've been married to you for 17 years and now... I left. I said, I'm going to teach her a lesson. I'm going to make the world know that she's psychotic, neurotic, incapable of raising children or running a household. And I hired a lawyer, popularly known as the Barracuda. $250 an hour. I said, I want to literally get this woman out on the streets. So help me you. And he was ready to help me. And my sponsor showed up on my shoulder at the meeting. He said, so what's the problem? Step one. I said, I don't want to lose my kids because every woman I know that divorces takes the kids because she wants a child support and all that. He said, have you asked her? This is my sponsor's voice. And I said, no, I haven't, but I know. Why don't you ask her? So I step out and I call my spouse and she said, what's going on? I said, I will not take you to court on one condition. She said, what? I said, I don't want to lose my kids. She said, you're an idiot. We have 4. I don't want them to myself. And I'm so blessed for my sponsor's voice. I miss him. He died 2 years ago for natural death last year. And my divorce cost me $700 through mediation. My former spouse still lives in the house that we both own. Not that because I'm noble. I just didn't want to upset the apple cart for my kids. She was very generous on the alimony arrangement and child support issues and all. We just never been to court to fight on anything. But we went to a divorce therapist, something that exists only in Southern California, I think, who said, don't get involved with women. She didn't say American women, just period, women. I said, are you nuts? I'm going to move to the island of Lesbos so I can be around women, but not with them. She smiled. She said, no, you don't understand. Give it 1 year. I said, okay. Month and a half later, I got involved. With a woman in my meeting who fluttered her eyelids at me and my ego just took off and she became the love of my life or the lust of my life or whatever you want to call it. And it was a phenomenal relationship for the first 6 months. And as had been predicted by the therapist, it crashed about a year later. And it hit me harder than my divorce had, because my divorce had been dying over a period of time. This was instantaneous. And I walked up to my sponsor and said, "Dean, do you have a gun?" And he said, "Why?" I said, "I'm too much of a coward to kill myself. Would you shoot me?" Instead, he said, "When was the last time you were alone?" I said, "I can't recall." He said, "Well, I suggest you lock yourself up for a couple of days and work on your fourth." I said, "Help me." That's the first time I asked my sponsor to help me. He said, "I want you to go to page 345 in the book called Courage to Change. Lock yourself up for a couple of days and answer the four questions you have in there." So I took Thanksgiving of 1997. I locked the doors. I threw away the remote. I shut off my phones. I called my former spouse, said, "The kids can't come over this weekend. I'm locked out. I'm going to work on my fourth." And I'd read a few books prior to that to sort of prep me. And I'm really, one book that I read was called How to Be an Adult, for God's sake. So the first question says, who am I? I have no idea. I'm like that actor, Woody Allen, that movie Zealing. You know, I am whoever you want me to be, and I have no idea who the hell I am. So I'm starting to write, and what's coming out is a lot of rage. My father never played cricket with me. My father didn't know how to hold a cricket bat. If you gave him one, said, "Which end should I hold?" He didn't know how to toss a ball. And I'm angry because my sister did not let me learn music, and I'm throwing all this crap out. But I started where I started. Who am I that I denied for the longest time? Tears are flowing, going through a cathartic experience that I did not expect. And a friend of mine told me, "Oh my God, you should have had a therapist with you when you did this." And I'm just pouring this stuff out. The second question was, what are your values? Now, I'd been to Catholic school with the values of honesty, loyalty, fidelity, none of which I had observed to the best of my abilities. But my sponsor changed it. He said, and I think he did it intuitively because he knew I was a concept fellow, not an action guy. So he said, "We're going to ask you, what are your values, or what do you value, and how do you show it?" "Do you value your children?" "Yes." "How do you show that?" "Do you value your business?" "Yes." "How do you show it?" "Do you value your friends?" "How do you show?" Action, 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 action. And God, I found there was very little action behind all the things I claimed I valued. Next question was, what traits of character do you wish to keep about you? And the last one was, what traits of character do you wish to get rid of? He made me do steps 4, 6, and 7, typically in one setting. And I walked up to him and I did my fifth on that Saturday. And for the first time, I felt my feet hit the ground. I look in the mirror, Darth Vader showed up and said, "Welcome to the dark side." Because you see, I denied everything base in me. If you said I was envious, I denied it. Yet if I saw you driving a nicer car than I did, I was envious. Just did not admit it to myself, but I felt it. I felt insecure, jealous, angry, fearful. All those things that I denied showed up on paper. And for the first time, I felt I could breathe without any constriction, that I had, I think psychologists call it being individuated. I had brought the basis self and the so-called higher self together and said, "This is who you are, warts and all, good and bad and ugly." And I'm so grateful to my sponsor for having me do that. The steps that I glossed over, steps 6 and 7, today are my mainstay steps, because to me, step 3 was not a step of surrender. It was simply a step of intention, a willingness to surrender. Steps 6 and 7 for me are the true steps of surrender, where I can actually say, I read my men's book. They use real contorted language sometimes. He said, you cannot move yourself off the center of your own endeavor. Simply put, you cannot get rid of your defects of character by yourself. I don't know why they did not put it in plain English, but I don't know why I remember that. It's like saying, scintillate, scintillate, asteroid, unifix, twinkle, twinkle, little star. So anyway, I use 6 and 7 if I'm having an ugly feeling. I'm angry, fearful. I say, "God, I surrender to you." And I actually go through the physical process. Sounds silly, but I cup my palm and I toss everything over. Step 8 has been a wonderful step for me, because reading this book, it says there are two types of guilt. There's neurotic guilt and there's real guilt. He said, for neurotic guilt, there is no restitution. For real guilt, there's restitution. You make amends. And I've learned in step 9, making amends really requires an action, saying sorry. I used to say sorry for being sorry. My 4-year-old then suggests and says, "What do you mean you're sorry, Dad? You keep saying that all the time. You don't do anything about it." Action. That's what my sponsor, you have to make restitution. Step 8, I tell you a story that I heard. It's a story about an elephant and an ant that meet in the circus and fall in love. and they get married. The night they consummate their marriage, the elephant dies. The ant wakes up in the morning, looks heavenward and says, "Oh God, for one night of pleasure, I have to spend a lifetime burying it." Guilt. And this is what the program is telling me. What are you feeling guilty about and whom are you hurting? Is it real guilt or is it neurotic guilt? Am I burying an elephant for one night of pleasure? Am I pleasuring every night and then carrying the guilt of it? So this program has really been something for me in terms of I am really grateful that I met the alcoholic in my life because it's brought me to this place. And it's brought me to a place where I feel comfortable in my skin. And it took me 17 years to get those feet to hit the ground. So be it. Because I figured if I'd caught it on early on, my arrogance would have known no bounds. You know, I could have walked around and told you how to live your lives. Today, I go to my fiance to her Greek Orthodox church on occasion. And they invited this priest from Massachusetts, who happened to be Australian. He's a Greek Orthodox priest, and he was giving a lecture on surrender. And I walked up to him and I said, "You know, what a lot of what you were saying sounds like 12-step stuff." He said, "I'm not an alcoholic, but I go to a lot of AA meetings." I said, "Why do you go to a lot of AA meetings?" He said, "Because there I find true spirituality more than I find in my own rooms of in the church." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because they understand their brokenness." And he says, "They know there's something greater than them exists to make them whole. So they are totally humbled by the fact." I said, "What about Al-Anon?" He said, "I haven't gotten much out of Al-Anon." And you know, it's okay because we think we are better than sometimes the alcoholic, but we are as broken in one sense because that's the realization this program has given me, that it's okay to be broken, to be connected to the source. I like what the Sufi poet Rumi says, "I do not wish to be the light, I wish to be one shy of the light so I can be in awe of the light." And that's what this program is teaching me all the time. To be comfortable in my skin, to mind my own business, to shift my paradigm, to change my attitudes, to essentially change my thinking, to become a renewed person. Actually, on April 2nd, 2003, I sat down and did a mini fourth. I wrote a letter to God because he had been going out with people, not connecting. My heart was just shut down. And I felt that I was getting involved in relationships where I was causing pain because the other person was starting to like me more than I was liking them, was falling in love with me when I wasn't. So I wrote a letter to God. I said, "I'm done hurting people. When you think I'm ready, you'll bring the right person into my life." And this woman had been coming to my meeting. She was 3 or 4 years old in program. And we became friends. There was nothing here, not dating or anything. And Scott Redmond's wife, Nancy, I think you've heard of Scott. He died recently, phenomenal AA speaker. His wife called me and said she's celebrating Scott's 20th AA birthday. And would I come and bring some friends with me? So I asked Vicky, I said, "Hey, I'm going to this gentleman's 20th anniversary. Would you like to go and ask another girlfriend to join you?" And she said, "Fantastic, I'll go." I was pleasantly surprised. So I pick her up. The other girlfriend doesn't show up. I said, "You still want to go?" She said, "Absolutely." So we end up at Scott's birthday. And then we're done. I said, "What do you want to do?" She said, "Oh, my kids are with my ex. Whatever you want to do." So we go to the Getty. And something happened at the Getty. And we've never been apart since. We had a couple-month breakup. What happened is they actually connected with someone that has exceeded what I had in my marriage and what I had in any other relationship because both of us are honest with each other. There's total transparency. And one thing I've learned more about myself in this bloody relationship. They say you discover yourself when you're in a true relationship. Because I thought I was not in any relationship, so I was detached. It's easy to be detached when you don't have anyone to focus over. All of a sudden, I find my control issues coming up, my insecurities coming up, and all these things coming up. So, oh my God, this is all about me, isn't it, again? And this relationship has also caused me to grow a lot. So I'm really, really grateful that my sponsor asked me to do that fourth. And if you haven't done your fourth, do it. I don't care. It's your program. Walk your path when you're ready. And I hope that you will someday do your fourth to discover yourself. I'll finish on this note. In terms of action, it's a story about a guy who goes to a feast, walks in, the nice people like it, they were sitting and eating outside, waiters and waitresses bustling about. This guy sits at his table, at his chair, his plate is empty, no one's waiting on him. 10 minutes go by, 20 minutes go by, 30 minutes go by, no one comes. Now he's getting really upset. He is so angry, he's about to leave. when he realizes it's a buffet. Just like program. You've got to get off your can and work the steps. They say, oh, I come to the program because I get it by osmosis. I can stand in a freaking garage next to a car for 20 years. I'm not becoming a car. You have to shove a transmission on my rear, and you have to radiate it on my nose, paint me red, and honk something on me. Perhaps I might resemble a car. For me, osmosis does not work. It's really, I need to work the steps, and I need to do them quite often for me. My men's meditation book says, if you do not know what step you're on, ask yourself if you're working the program. And that's a pretty tall order. But once again, Steve, thanks for asking me to come babble. And I'm grateful that I did come, despite the traffic on the 605 and the 210.
You want to do it?
Want to do it now?
No, let me get some. No, I'll get you right back up. Come back up here, Ajit, please. We'd like to give you a token of our appreciation. We have a little pin a lot of the men wear that says, it's a guitar, it says 7 o'clock, let's rock. We'd like you to have that with our thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I want to thank the Academy.
Okay, thanks, Ajit, so much. Jack C. would like to make an announcement, please.
I'm Jack.
Hey, Jack.
How you guys all like the new facility? Isn't it beautiful up here? This is the first time we've had our anniversary up here in this beautiful room with the courtyard out there. With the amplification, everything is beautiful. I'd like to make sure that we leave the place better than we found it. So the guys that help set up, that know where the chairs go, the folding chairs are going to go up the hill into a room up there. Somebody will show you how to do that. Want to make sure the tables are wiped down. The chairs in here need to be stacked 10 high, and they need to be perfectly straight. All the legs got to be exactly on front of the other ones. Otherwise, the next people that put them on the dolly, they'll tip over and fall on them. It's actually very dangerous, so be careful about that. We got a lot of newcomers here tonight. This is a little intimidating when you walk into a group this big. If you want to stop being intimidated, grab somebody or follow somebody who's cleaning up in this place and hauling chairs, do what they're doing, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for making this a real success tonight. It's been a real sweet homecoming for me, and I love you guys. So I'd like to ask Josiah if he'd come up and read the closing and pray us out of here. Hope he's here. Not here? Josiah's not here? Okay. Okay, John, our engineer. Thanks for volunteering. I don't know where the animal is closing. What page, Jack? Oh, he has to think. Huh? 24. There you go. Thanks, buddy.
All right. Hi, I'm John. In closing, I would like to say that the opinions expressed here were strictly those of the person who gave them. Take what you liked and leave the rest. The things you heard were spoken in confidence and should be treated as confidential. Keep them within the walls of this room and the confines of your mind. A few special words to those of you who haven't been with us long. Whatever your problems, there are those among us who have had them too. Try to keep an open mind. You will find help. You will come to realize that there is no situation too difficult to be bettered, and no unhappiness too great to be lessened. We aren't perfect. The welcome we give you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts for you. After a while, you'll discover that though you may not like all of us, you'll love us in a very special way, the same way we already love you. Talk to each other, reason things out with someone else, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Will all who care to, please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God.
God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work.
Happy birthday, friend.